Rock is lit.
I'm really excited about this special episode of Rock is Lit. It's the first for the podcast, actually, a panel discussion with four amazing women rock novelists hailing from Canada to Chicago to L.A. and back to my neck of the woods here in Asheville, North Carolina. Kirstie McKenzie, Mallory Smart, Claire Hoppel, and Rock is Lit veteran Jessamine Violet are joining me to talk about our experiences and thoughts about writing fiction about musicians. Jessamine Violet is a writer and musician out of Venice Beach, California. Her debut novel, Secret Rules to Being a Rock Star, was published in April 2023 by Three Rooms Press. Short fiction can be found in Plowshares, Lit Angeles, 805 Art Plus Lit Journal, and more. She is also the drummer for the psych rock band Movie Club. Mallory Smart is a Chicago-based writer and editor-in-chief of Maudlin House. Some people even call her the only living girl in Chicago. Mallory is the host of the podcast Textual Healing and co-hosts That Horror Cast with Dmitry Samarov. Her latest book, I Keep My Visions to Myself, just came out from Within X Books. Kirstie McKenzie is the author of Better to Beg, as well as editor-in-chief of Major Seventh Magazine. Her work has been published in HAD, Rejection Letters, Tramp Set, Autofocus, Maudlin House, Identity Theory, and elsewhere. Claire Hoppel is the author of six books and the fiction editor at X-Ray. Her stories have appeared in Wigley, Volume 1 Brooklyn, Forever Mag, and others. She grew up in the woods of Pennsylvania and currently lives in Asheville, North Carolina. Her next book, Take It Personally, is forthcoming from Stalking Horse Press in February 2025. Each of these four talented authors brings a unique perspective to the conversation, from the creative sparks that ignite our own work to the cultural impacts of rock novels in general. We'll navigate the winding paths of character development and uncovering the challenges of breathing life into fictional musicians while honoring the essence of their real-life counterparts. We'll delve into the stigma surrounding rock novels, dissecting perceptions and stereotypes to reveal the nuanced portrayals crafted by these talented authors. And of course, no discussion on writing fiction about musicians would be complete without reflecting on current trends and the evolution of the genre, including the explosive success of Taylor Jenkins Reid's rock novel, Daisy Jones and the Six. So tune in and turn up the volume as Rock is Lit takes you on a journey through the pages of rock literature, where every word is a chord and every story a kick-ass concert. Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for joining me on what I know is going to be a really fun conversation. I'm so glad you're here.
What's up?
Happy to be here.
And special thanks to Jessamine for bringing my attention to this subject and getting the ball rolling on this. So kudos to you.
Well, Mallory came to me with the idea and I just ran with it to the best person for the job, in my opinion. Oh. So. Thank you for having us, Kirstie. Seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great topic and it's something that we all know a little something about. So I think the best way to get started is for each of you to share a little bit about yourself and what inspired or inspires you to write about music and musicians in your fiction. So Jessamine, you want to start?
Sure. I am both a writer and a musician. I actually played piano since I was a kid, but when I started writing my first book, I picked up drumstick and joined a band, and it was love at first drum. So I was writing about musicians for my first novel anyway, because I've always been equally obsessed. So you can't really write a lot of songs about writing, but you can write fiction about musicians. So for me, it's been dual passion since I was born. I played piano, I was obsessed with classical music and the Beatles and all the stuff as a young child. And then I was DJ at several college radio stations and then wrote about live shows and interviewed musicians for magazines for years. And then it was just natural progression. Of course, when I wrote my first book, I wanted it to be about music and musicians. Yeah. So
my name's Kirsty, and I wanted to, I guess for inspiration, it's twofold. One of them is that musicians lead very uprooted lives. And my life is very rooted. And so there's something about the lore of bands and musicians and the way that they're kind of tumbleweeds and they're just sort of blowing through towns and, you know, they're constantly on tour. That's really fascinating to me. And it's a life not led for me. And so there's something about that that just inspires me, makes me want to pursue it in my writing. And I also like sort of writing about transitory spaces, or I guess you could call them liminal spaces. And I feel like places like airports or hotels or bus depots, things like that, I'm really interested in the way that that sort of interacts with identity and how identity can be very fluid in those spaces. So that's those two things intersect for me. And the other one is sort of a pet peeve of mine. I don't like it when writers write about being writers. So I took like the lateral way of doing it, which is like navel gazing as an artist by writing about the progression of an artist's life in the terms of a musician. And I feel like I can still do that like navel gazy thing of like, I'm writing about being an artist, but I'm not writing about being a writer. So yeah. I wound up going with musicians instead. So that's where the inspiration comes for me.
Honestly, I'm kind of a wannabe musician. I kind of was when I was younger. I attempted to do like a Riot Girl band. It was horrible. We were called Classy Ladies. And when I was done with that, I actually would just hang out with friends on a curb and we would just like be playing mandolin and guitar. And by curb, I mean like a 24-hour parking lot outside of a Denny's. And that heavily inspired me to do this because as a writer, I started getting very nostalgic for that time for when you can create for yourself and not just the audience. And that's very much what my book is about.
I'm probably the least qualified to be here in the sense that I don't actually know that much about music, besides being in chorus, you know, in high school, and living in Nashville for about 6 years and just accidentally befriending a ton of musicians in the process, because everybody in Nashville is a musician. You just need to go to even the frozen yogurt place. It's so sad. Had somebody playing at all times. Like Kirsty, I also use writing about musicians as a way to sort of talk about writing without talking about writing because it's a pet peeve of mine as well. But specifically for the novel that's coming out in February through Stalking Horse Press.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's called Take It Personally, and it was a more of a plot device, a way of moving things forward and holding suspense because the main character goes on tour in the middle of that book, but it's also a way of addressing imposter syndrome, which I think we can all relate to no matter what we're doing. And it was also a foil against the other main character who was an actual celebrity. The main character is not and is following a celebrity. And so it was a way to just show the stark contrast between their lives and how one is enamored with the concept of celebrity, but is just not there and is doing a sort of a private investigator type deal, amateur private investigator job. So hopefully that made sense. But.
Have there been any personal experiences or encounters that have significantly influenced your writing in this genre? And anybody can jump in.
I mean, it's hard to say one, you know, but I will say, like, something that really got me going was that, weirdly, like, my dad is a big nerd, you know, and he has always worked at weird companies where I don't know what to say he really does, you know. But when right before I moved to California, it was an interesting situation because he went to business school with the owner of Gibson Guitar. So he got a job as COO of Gibson Guitar, like, you know, a few months before I moved to LA. And I was going blind. I knew some people from Emerson there, but like when I got there, he kind of like plugged me into some Gibson people from the start. And it was hugely shaped the plot of my first book because I was thrown into this like, you know, crazy, you know, A-list situation by going to these charity events and shows and meeting all these major league players as a little bright-eyed 22-23-year-old. And, you know, I had some, you know, situations arise that like I loosely borrowed from in the book. And, so I think, you know, a combination of the people that I met through having that weird, it was such an anomaly because he only lasted that job for 9 months. It's a hot seat, as they say, like very high turnover, hard to handle position. So it felt like just a gift from the universe because if that hadn't been the case, my first book's content would be hugely different. So
living in Nashville for a little while, it was just pretty incredible to walk down the street and see famous musicians at your local Mexican restaurant getting a margarita alongside you, walking into Trader Joe's and seeing Taylor Swift. And it was just a wild time to be there. A lot of people were moving from California at that time. And as someone who grew up in the middle of nowhere in the woods in Pennsylvania, literally whittling sticks as a child with my Swiss Army knife, it was quite an experience. So I think that did shape me a little bit as I was writing this last novel.
Quite honestly, I started writing influenced by my favorite band and their lore a little bit. And I was writing scenes. I needed to get going in my writing. So I was using prompts, writer's prompts, and just writing these little scenes, and these two characters just sort of popped out. And so they were very, very loosely based on my favorite band. But I didn't have any personal encounters. I did have some musicians read it after the fact. and I feel, we'll get into this a bit later, but I definitely feel a bit of imposter syndrome writing about musicians. But yeah, no personal encounters for me.
No personal encounters. No romances even?
No. Come on. No, not even. I had a very, very, very brief fling with a guitarist from like my hometown, but that happened after the book was written. So
are there any specific techniques or rituals that any of you employ when you're drafting? Like, do you listen to music while you're writing? Because I have to have complete silence. I can't listen to it while I'm writing, even though it usually inspires what I'm writing.
Well, I host Textual Healing, which is almost devoted entirely to what people listen to while they're writing. So I actually make a playlist for what I intend to write. That's my big deal. But this is going to be like the dorkiest thing. I turn K-pop on repeat because it just kind of blends through. And yeah, so that gets you going for me. And also,
while you're writing techniques, or is it before?
It's while I'm writing beforehand, I'll kind of jam out. I think I've shared the playlist I made for this book with a lot of people. So yeah.
So is K-pop like your white noise?
Yeah, it is. I do that, or sometimes I do rain sounds. That's like really soothing for me.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of Scary Guys, Skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month. So just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
I have to listen to music. And it has to be something that I actually want it to have lyrics, but nothing too distracting. I pretty much default to three Fleetwood Mac albums, all deep tracks, none of the hits that everyone's heard a million times. Mallory knows this. She's also Fleetwood Mac. Husk. But really anything that kind of that has a somewhat chill vibe, but is still expressing a great deal of emotion at the same time.
I also make a playlist, or like I'll listen to things that are specific to the genre of like the musician that I'm writing about. So for my novel, Better to Beg, it was about early aughts garage bands and indie bands. And so I listened to a lot of those early aughts bands that like were very like New York cool, I guess you could say. So the Kills and the White Stripes and the Strokes and LCD Sound System, those were all the National, all those bands were really really sort of pivotal. And for me, it becomes white noise when I crank it as loud as I possibly can and just sort of use the energy of it, but zone out on the lyrics. And so there are songs that I would just play continuously on repeat sometimes during a certain scene. I remember writing one scene. I really liked the Hell or High Water soundtrack as well, because it's also like a road trip film, even though it's a heist. And so I used that. And I listened to Colter Wall's, the song he does, I can't remember it right now. It's a pretty famous song, but I listened to his tune over and over and over again during one specific scene. So that's my mode, as loud as it can possibly go, and sometimes obsessively on the same tracks while I'm doing it, and specific to the time and the genre to get the feel for it.
Are you all doing Spotify playlists, Large Hearted Boy playlists, or are these just personal playlists?
I did a Spotify playlist, two of them actually, and then also I was on Large Hearted Boy. Most of my music centered around kind of like things that make you feel like you're LA in night, like just lost in the city wandering around. So I had a lot of Bob Seger, I had some Fleetwood Mac going on, but a lot of ELO as well for some reason.
Yes.
Wow.
Love ELO.
Yeah.
Telephone Line on repeat.
I just picture Steve Buscemi putting on lipstick in Billy Madison every time I hear that, and it makes me smile.
Let's talk about some challenges to writing about music, because it's not always easy. I mean, building characters who are supposed to be famous, those of you who are actually writing about real people and or referencing music that nobody's heard of can create a void for readers. So how do you handle that? What are some of the challenges that you faced in writing about music?
Not being a musician was the main one. I guess the thing that I wanted to sort of get out of the way was not writing kind of scenes that were primarily focused on performance. And I felt like in order to do it well, like in order to write about musicians well, you had to write about all the things around the music. But not being a musician gave me a lot of imposter syndrome, because I was sort of like, who am I to be writing this? And I still get that sometimes. And I had that feeling most acutely after releasing the book. I'm still wrestling with it. Especially as musicians pick it up or people that are in that industry. I've had, you know, agents or musicians sort of like pick it up, and I'm a little bit nervous for their response to it. But that's the primary one is having such a rooted life and only relying so hard on research that I've done or like rock biographies that I've read over the years. That's more or less what I'm relying on. It's just all the things I've taken in, and I'm hoping that I can sort of synthesize that with my feelings about being an artist, especially being an up and coming artist, and make it, you know, as realistic as I possibly can. But that's a major challenge, is not having ever been a musician. Big one.
I completely agree. I'm just going to piggyback off that answer, because that's exactly how I feel. And I think the reason that it didn't maybe haunt me as much is because I also wasn't focused on the technical performance so much, but more about what happened before and after various shows. And all of my characters are extremely quirky, and so they're not going to do things the way that normal musicians would anyway. And so that gave me a kind of freedom amid the challenge, I think.
Yeah, I went slapstick with mine. Like, I'm just going to get out of this by going slapstick comedy in a lot of these scenarios.
I mean, I did the same thing too, where I tried to leave performances out as much as possible, because I feel like as a writer, it's really difficult to actually describe music. I mean, if you ask anybody, I feel like most people would say that music actually transcends language to a certain degree. So that was a very big thing for me to deal with. So yeah, I kind of always kept the music and the performances on the periphery and kept with the introspective nature of the writer.
Yeah, I think that that's like well advised, you know, in my book too, in Secret Rules to Being a Rockstar, like the main character goes to LA to be in a band, but they keep trying to rehearse, but they never actually even rehearse. So it's like, kind of writing around the actual performances and focusing on the personality and the drama is way more compelling, especially when it comes to like a fictional. Because if you're writing about a famous band, you're writing about their performance, everyone already can kind of like associate that's reading it. Like, oh, I can see the, you know, singer doing that. Or like, you know, if I was to write about the Kills show I went to, you know, it was like, Billy Idol was sitting two rows up and Alison Mosshart was very exhausted because it was like their last show of the whole 7 months, 7 weeks they'd been on the road. So she like collapsed on the stage while dancing at one point. It was like,
wow.
But see, I can talk about the performance. Everyone's interested. But if I'm talking about this fictional performance of a band, you know, no one's going to really care. So yeah, I was definitely that is a challenge. And if I was to write a sequel, I would also have to kind of dance around that. And your eyes just like kind of glaze over because it's like you're using a whole nother section of your brain when you're listening to music. That, yeah, it's really hard to nail down
with words.
I think another challenge is, you know, just writing around the cliches of being a musician, you know, because there are certain people have certain ideas. But the truth is there's just all types of musicians, just like every other role out there. You're not going to have one type of person doing it. So,
I mean, that comes to breaking down the stigma of like what rock novels are. They're supposed to be like crazy sex, drugs, rock and roll type. Always a male singer.
Right.
I'm getting the feeling that most of you are writing about fictional bands. Do you think that's harder than writing about an actual musician? Because, Jessamine, you were talking about if you write about that musician and that particular performance, everybody already knows what that was like. So maybe it's easier to translate that or to connect with the reader. And the challenge then, if you're writing about a band or an artist that nobody knows, is how do you make them jump off the page? How do you make people fall in love with that musician when they're not actually hearing the music? It's just what you're creating on the page.
Absolutely. That's a huge, huge challenge because that is like the magnetism, the spell of musicians is cast through you watching them perform live, of course. So there has to be some mention of what they do that's special, but you can't actually have the reader experience that sort of thing. Yeah. Which is why it's cool when authors land book deals along with record deals that and they can do fictional bands of their characters and they get to be released simultaneously and
I remember, Jessamine, when I met you and I first interviewed you for Rock is Lit, you mentioned that you were having a hard, well, I mean, obviously you'd sold the book by then it came out, but you had had a hard time convincing some publishers to take it on because of the stigma against rock novels. Can you talk a little bit more about your experience with that or what your thoughts are about that stigma?
Yeah, I mean, I guess just, you know, in the past, books about music or musicians like haven't sold well, was what I was told for years. You know, don't put the performances in. I was told to take the lyrics out, things like that. I was told to change characters to like vampires and zombies to try to make it more marketable, things like that. Yeah. Because I shopped my first book around for an incredibly long time, and it went through several different agents, and it was just a very, very long nightmare process. But I still wanted to stick with it because it was, at that point, it's just like you want to see it through. You put so much time and effort into things. But then, you know, also there can be a shift in the like overall climate, and it seemed like all of a sudden YA was up on an upswing. Queer novels were up on upswing and writing about musicians suddenly getting more popular. So a combination of those things, and I found, you know, very small press and things like that. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's just like, and now that Daisy Jones is hit, I think, you know, people can't say that anymore. Mm-hmm. And they can't say that with a straight face because now there is a bestseller that's strictly about musicians. It's fiction. So
yeah,
it felt like a win, you know, like the hole's a little wider now. The crack is a little wider.
And I think too that Daisy Jones succeeded so wildly because it was about the periphery of things that happen around the recording. Like it's very much, and she cribbed from a very famous story from the Fleetwood Mac Rumors album.
Uh-huh.
People love that story. The same way that they love the lore of musicians all the time. Anyone who is into music history loves the personal stuff around the album as much as they love the album itself. They love the things that inform that. And so I think that writing around it helps break down the stigma and creating lore, and that goes part and parcel to what you said about making the characters interesting. Is like, all you have to do is think about the kind of ups and downs of a musician's life or the trajectory of a musician's life. And it's a little bit different for all musicians, but they still sort of have these periods of time that you can track, and they track very well in biographies and autobiographies. So why not in fiction? And we've seen that, like Jessamine was saying, we've seen it in the last few years. They can't say anymore with a straight face that doesn't sell, because there's a market for it. And Taylor Jenkins found it, and she found it with one of the most famous stories of all time. And we ate it up. We knew the story, and we ate it up anyway. So I think that I think that people love being told those stories over and over and over again, just in different ways. So I think that that lends itself to breaking down that stigma that we've seen is shying away from just adulation of like performance and just talking about the gossip around it, because they lead very juicy lives and often very messy lives. And I think that that's part of the appeal, big part of the appeal.
I think a big part of it might also have to do with Gen Z and TikTok and how much they actually help like push Daisy Jones. I'm curious whether Daisy Jones would have been as popular if her previous book, Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, wasn't as popular, because that was like a huge smash hit that was optioned also. Have any of you read it?
No, but when I looked her up, I looked up the author, and that was like what her like 11th novel Daisy Jones was, which is crazy. But like, I'm
she puts us all to shame.
And she does that kind of like cribbing from famous people's lives and turning them into her own story. She does that so well. Like she does it in a way that you sort of know, and you're drawing on your reference from pop culture to feed the character that she's making. But it's also a brand new story. So she's kind of perfected this, you know, breezy beach read that is sort of juicy and gossip filled and draws on these stories that you already know, and she tells them. Like, she's found a market for it, and it's clearly exploded, because she did, I think Malibu Rising was kind of low key about a Frank Sinatra character and his kids and sort of the effect that his womanizing had on this family that he created and on these generations of people. So she's figured out how to take celebrity and write about it in a more accessible way, and in a way that's compelling and a page turner, and obviously accesses massive audiences. Like you said, Book Talk picks up on it.
Side note, she went to Emerson. She was in my class, but she wasn't a writing major. She wasn't a writing major.
Oh, she was in a film, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really funny.
But Kirstie, you said something that caught my attention. You mentioned beach read, because there have been so many amazing rock novels before this. And they've been books that have used pop culture icons that have, like, I'm thinking particularly of Zachary Lazar's novel Sway, and he's got members of the Manson family in it. He's got the avant-garde artist Kenneth Anger in it, and you know, it's the Rolling Stones, early Rolling Stones, all of that stuff all wrapped up together. And that those pop culture references are just as interesting, at least to me, as the Fleetwood Mac story, as interesting as that is. But I think you hit the nail on the head when you said she figured out a way to tell the story so that it's very accessible to everybody. It's a beach read. Zachary Lazar's novel is a lot more intellectual. It's a lot more literary. So, you know, maybe that's the difference right there.
Yeah, and I want to say too that some people use beach read as like a pejorative. Like they're basically saying that it's like not a good thing, right? They're using it as something that's like, that doesn't have anything to say. And I would disagree with that. I think that she has a lot of commentary on celebrity and on fame and on, you know, the lives of these people that she's writing about that she's doing, but like you said, in a less like heavy intellectual way. It's still there. That commentary is still there.
Right. It's just more accessible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that she's done that in a way that, yeah, finds its audience. And I would be lying if I said I don't study it just a little bit, because she's done it for the biggest audience. They're getting adapted. I think that without being cynical, if we're sort of aiming for a large audience, she's probably spawned a lot of imitators, I'd say. And I think that there's a way to sort of take what she's doing and adapt it for your own work. And you can put as much commentary or as little as you want. But the point stands that because so many people have references in pop culture, and I don't know about anyone else, but when I was doing, low-key education and creative writing, we were sort of told to steer clear of pop culture references because it might date the work. And I always bucked against that. I thought, that doesn't make any sense. I think that makes it relatable. And I think now we're seeing in publishing, especially in the sort of indie lit space, people love references to pop culture because it's a bond. It's sort of a shared thing that we can draw on. And
it also could be like a personality trait and everything. It defines someone's class and their background and, yeah, sorry for interrupting.
No, it's okay. I'm hammering on about it because it fascinates me endlessly. But
it just made me think of like American Psycho and stuff like that, where it's like, oh, he's obsessed with the Rolex, he's obsessed with that, things like that.
And he does those diatribes about albums in the middle of it, right? And there's,
oh my god, I love that.
There's this sort of relatability that he has as a psychopath, where like he's doing a deep dive on these as he's doing these horrific things, and all this to say that pop culture is a kind of, it's a touchstone that people can relate to. And so I think that that's a big piece of making these things accessible, right? So yeah, that's my thought on that. I don't know if anyone else has any.
Oh, that was great.
Well, I think also that characters don't exist in a vacuum. And like what you were saying, Mallory, what you're interested in with regard to music or movies or certain foods or certain brands of clothing says a lot about who you are or who that character is, that character's background. So I always have included pop culture references in my work because it's so much a part of who I am as a person anyway.
I mean, I actually had included it at the end of my book where they do a secret movie club thing. And Jessamine immediately was like, oh my God, have you done that? And it's like, yeah, see, there's a personality thing that like I just threw out there for you, so you actually understand the kind of person she is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was very cool to find that. I mean, obviously as Movie Club, the band, we are a big fan and we've done a mashup event with them. And it was very cool to see you spotlight them at the end of your book. But have you done that? I forget.
No.
Man. How did you like find
you
out
could
about
immediately it? Like come up with a conclusion though, of, like what she's like though, since you know what it is and everything.
Yeah, but I wouldn't even call that a pop culture reference. You know what I mean? That's like kind of like subculture reference.
It is true. Duncan Birmingham told me about it.
Amazing. What a guy. I'm glad he's representing. He'd probably say vidiots if it had been these times. Vidiots is the new hot theater in town, but.
I did not encounter the stigma of writing about musicians when I went to submit this novel that we're talking about. I encountered another stigma that I feel like no one talks about, which is word count and how in America, it's all about word count. It's a gatekeeper to if you want to be taken seriously, if you want to even query agents, it needs to be a certain length. And how other countries don't have that stigma. I pick up New Directions translations all the time, and they're some of my favorite books ever. And they're these slim, quote-unquote, novels that are maybe 85 pages long, and I'm obsessed with them. And that's where our attention span is heading, or already is. And so it's baffled me that the publishing industry has not caught up with the rest of the world and with our mindsets in that sense. Now, I realize there are people who look to a novel to just wrap themselves up in it and get lost and be in this 500-page tome and feel so invested. And there is definitely space for that. But to only have space for that is where I get a little confused and a little bit bitter, I guess. So
but I love how to the point you are.
Thank you. I do think pacing is a challenge for me, and it's something that I've been working on a lot lately and can always work on, but still, that's all. That's my rant.
What was your word count?
With which, so I've already finished a different novel since the musician one.
Claire's crushing it.
So the one that's coming out in February is only like 21,000 words, which is why, you know, I didn't even really try to send it anywhere to agents. But then I have a new one that's 41,000. So it's like barely in the door. Somebody told me the average novel's like 60,000 words, but 40,000 and above will get you in the door, basically.
Wait, so this one coming out on Stalking Horse is only 21,000?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So it's a novella. That's what they're calling it?
Well, I mean, some people call that a novella, and I think that's a traditional definition of what a novella is, but I've seen shorter novels, and they call them novel, and I don't know if it's a marketing ploy or different definition or what have you, but it's all over the board. Like you see it all, and it makes me wonder why that's such a hang up to begin with.
It's interesting.
I had mine with query and Big Five in mind, and I wrote it, I think it was 85,000 to 88,000 words or something, and I was like, okay, it has to be this length. I have to make it this length in order to like query. And my book took a different journey. I wound up self-pubbing it, but and even now, having like you said, our attention spans are changing, and I like shorter novels now. I think that that's all. I think that that's the way it's going, and I think that there's something really rewarding about telling a story in a very compressed amount of time and not rambling on with it. And I think that my first one, I'm glad that it was the length that it was, but my next one, certainly, like you said, Claire, I'm adjusting my notions of what a marketable book looks like. And the next one's going to be shorter for that. Cause I agree that people's attention spans are adjusting, and micro and flash are the de rigueur now, right? It's the way that people are consuming things is in short little bites. And I think that, again, without being cynical, you do kind of want to meet the reader where they're at. And also as a writer, you know, do you need 88,000 words to tell this story? Can it be told in 20, 40 or 60,000 words? I think that it depends on the story itself. But yeah, in terms of industry stuff, I agree that there's a stigma with that when you're querying, for sure, because they're looking for that kind of standard. Oh, if we're going to put this on a shelf in a Barnes & Noble or in an Indigo, like we want it to be 300 pages. And I just don't think that that's not the direction that things are going on the ground. It is very antiquated. I agree with you.
Yeah. As a reader, I don't like description for description's sake. Just like I don't like going to a restaurant that's fancy for fancy's sake, and you eat the food and you're like, what is the big deal? So yeah, I think part of it is my own consumption habits too.
I love it that there are more and more small presses that focus on music and literature, rock novels. There's so many of them now. Maudlin really is interested in the rock novel. And there's what was your publisher, Jessamine? Three rooms.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot now. So maybe there was a stigma with big houses, but it seems like that's not the case with small publishing, small presses.
I think Clash Books too is also like, they just have a very like metal ethos. Like, even if they're not, all those books aren't specifically about rock. Some of them are. I think they did like the history of ska or something, or In Defense of Ska was a big one. And even if they're ska, not,
that was a good one.
That is a good one.
Oh, and it's beautifully packaged too. I don't know if you've seen it, but like, holy moly, it's a beautiful book. But their whole ethos is extremely rock and roll. So even if the books aren't directly about rock music, like, I think that indie presses are kind of carrying that torch of like,
totally.
Yeah.
Well, Clash is not a musician, right? I mean, isn't he in a band too? I think that probably helps. But yeah, Mallory, I feel like you've always done a great job with Maudlin of pushing people that, I don't know, I want to read.
The weirder, the better.
The weirder, the better.
You know what, Claire? I published you, really, so of course you know.
And I was like, that might come off as kind of weird since you published me, but that's not what I meant.
I really love the design of your books too, Mel. Like,
yeah, thank you.
The website looks great, and just all the books look great.
Thank you very much. I feel like this is just like pat me on the back. Thank you. But no, I think the cool thing with small presses is that like they're almost acting like indie labels, you know, where like each press could actually like act as like specializing in one thing. I think it's interesting, Kirsty, that you said Clash was so rock and roll, which it totally is, but I vibe that they're so much more obsessed with horror.
Yeah, I think that was like where they got their start, and then they kind of put literary under the fold as well too. So I think that it's like a really cool meeting of those two like worlds, because they I know Christoph is like particularly interested in horror, and mm-hmm. then I think that they just kind of merged with like literary fiction as well. So I feel like everything that they publish kind of has that undertone too, which is very cool. And yeah, a lot of the indie presses are leading the way in terms of breaking down stigma around word count and showing that you can write books that are 20, 40, 60,000 words and have them be fascinating literature and still like a satisfying story to read in a more compressed format. Like if I can knock off two or three indie books in a week, and I feel, if as opposed to just say like one that's 300 or 400 pages, and I feel like I've gained as much from those short works as I do from you know, the longer novel as well. So I try and like balance that with my reading novels from big five presses as well. So it's a much bigger part of my diet than it was before, my literary diet.
And it's totally analogous to album length. I even title different manuscript versions EP, LP.
I love that.
That's
so cool.
Yeah.
Okay, he's doing the double album there. And I think there's a place for that. I know we're talking about shorter work, and I think that's great, but I think there's a place for the longer work as well. And I think it just really depends on what your story is and how big of a scope you have.
And there's totally a place for longer works. There's no question. I just feel like it seems like at times in certain markets, there's only a place.
Mm-hmm. I would say, as a publisher, I get really intimidated when people send me things that are way too long as well. Anything over 100,000 words, I'm just like, no, thank you.
You gotta cut that by 40,000.
Because the smaller presses have like less resources and less time and less people involved, right? Like,
yeah,
they can't afford to be reading things that are 100,000 words long. But I think that it's like a guitar solo. There's like a limit of time, and then anything after that, it becomes masturbatory. So there's like,
gratuitous, yeah.
Yeah, it's gratuitous. I'm
curious about, you know, if there's any kind of research any of you had to do outside of just your own personal experience. Like, Jessamine is a musician. Did anybody have to go and do any kind of research? Because I know from my book, because I think I'm the only one who was writing about a real rock star. So I was traveling to England to go to all of these Led Zeppelin related locations and, doing all that kind of thing. But did you all have to do any research for your books?
Most of my research was devoted actually to the location, and I just used the majority of my knowledge of rock stars and how they actually dealt with the writer's block and struggling with their own identities and everything. I mean, I drew a lot from Matt Schultz from Cage the Elephant when he was having issues trying to write Melophobia. So, yeah, he went pretty intense into discussing how he would actually drag his friends into his house and like tell him like their life stories, and he would like type it out on a typewriter until something like jogged loose and everything. So I used stuff like that, and Patti Smith, who said that like she would have dreams and immediately wake up and write it down, and that would turn into a song. But I just used that knowledge, and then the only other thing I had to research was actually how to write a song, especially like song notes, because that doesn't come naturally to me.
Yeah, I had to do a ton of research for mine because it was they were all places I'd never been, so I had to kind of research what a college rock tour might look like and the locations that they'd stop. I had to like research U.S. geography because it was like a road trip that I hadn't taken. I researched what it was like for indie bands in New York at the time. So like in the very early 2000s, and specific to like bars that they went to and that they would have played at. And I researched down to like, were there specific gas stations near these hotels or things like that. I had to go pretty deep for those sorts of things to try and make it as realistic as I could, I think, because I didn't want to flub those parts. And if I'd never been, I reverse engineered a trip to kind of do a leg of the road trip.
Did you look up these places on Yelp at all? Because I did that for mine.
No, not on Yelp. That wasn't it. There was a lot of like Google image search. There was a lot of,
oh, that's good.
Yeah. There was like reading books from the time I read Meet Me in the Bathroom obsessively. I think I read it 6, 7, 8 times to make sure that I got those details right. But yeah, lots of Google image searches and trying to search these very famous hotels, Chateau Marmont or Hotel Chelsea, trying to, get pictures of them or accounts from people who had stayed there without having stayed there myself. So there was a lot of research involved in mine.
See, Yelp, for me, a great idea. Yelp was actually, yeah, it really was. I just got everyone's reviews. And then I was on Reddit a lot too.
Yeah, I just looked at Google Maps and I did some research. There's one band member who's enamored with roadside attractions, giant statues, world's largest tea kettle, that kind of thing. And so I had a lot of fun looking stuff like that up, but less about the music itself, I think.
I think the other thing I got the most into researching was the Cecil Hotel, because I have a really huge long chapter devoted to a hotel that's based off that. So I think I got into the biggest wiki wormhole ever.
See, other than maybe shorter novels, where do you see the trend going for fiction about music musicians, especially given the runaway success of Daisy Jones and the Six? Do you see, I mean, first of all, do you see the genre changing, the industry changing, or what do you see coming down the pike?
I mean, I think we're going to see a lot more imitations of it for sure. I mean, once you get something that hits like a huge Amazon deal, then you're just going to have a lot of repeats and everything. It's just like, does anyone else remember like the huge franchise obsession? You know, like Harry Potter, Twilight, Hunger Games, and there's a, I forget the other one, but no one cared. It was like canceled like halfway through.
band was that? I'm curious.
Oh my god, it starts with a D. I don't know, but they even filmed the series in Chicago, and they actually rapped like in the middle of it. Like, oh, no one's paying attention because they hated the last book.
Wow.
So I imagine that we might eventually get to that point where you're just going to have an oversaturated market. Hopefully not. If you have the right writers and they're taking different like angles and everything, but if you're going to have a lot of people who are going to be doing the, this is based off of this band, the I'm with the band kind of story, then yeah, I think you get pretty tired pretty quickly. But I think we all did a good job, exception of Claire, because I haven't actually read your book. I'm sure you did a great job of it, of actually focusing on the introspective nature.
I would love to see like a music section, but like books about
yes
section in a bookstore. Has anyone ever seen that? Yeah, like it just seems like all the bookstores have to do is like start, you know, putting it together, grouping it. I feel like, you know, it would be a lot more like kid friendly too, because I feel like teenagers, you know, they're so obsessed with music, and I don't know if they had like an easy like go to shelf, you know, like sci-fi.
Why are teenagers so drawn to our literature about bands?
Because they're cool, obviously.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, like they want books that have, you know, stuff in them that like isn't pre, you know, packaged or just canned. Like a lot of stuff is really vanilla, you know, a lot of the YA stuff. And I tried to like at least put stuff in mind, like that the parents wouldn't approve of and the kid would want to like hide under their bed. Like that was to me, you know, those were the books that I liked growing up. Although my parents never had any book bans because they were cool and both super book nerds. So they said I could have any book I wanted, but I'm just saying like kids want to read stuff that is a little above their like age level.
There's a kind of wild energy, I think, to bands and the lore around them that teenagers and young people really like. I remember one of my beta readers saying, you know, this is very firmly about a book. It's a book about people in their 20s, and there's a kind of energy to it that you can't replicate as you get a bit older. And I think that for the same reason that teenagers discover the Beats and they respond to the wild energy and like On the Road, it's channeling that same sort of youth and that same sort of abandon. And I think it's stories that are maybe a little edgier than what's marketed to teens or to young adults.
I mean, do you think because it's about like running away from the more conventional lifestyle?
Could be. And I think too that music makes such an impact at that age in a way that like sticks with you the rest of your life in terms of what sort of form the impressions that you form on that thing. I think they said that like this is why dad rock is a thing, just because people get stuck on bands from their youth or like the sounds of their youth, whatever that is. It doesn't necessarily have to be the thing they came of age with. It could be like if you listen to Fleetwood Mac a lot in your 20s and you're just like, this is what I like, this is what I've imprinted on, this is my measure for everything. You're transported back to a time where you felt everything really keenly. And I think that that's
nostalgia. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that literature about that channels that. And it shifts all the time too. Like things they're calling dad rock now are like things that we came of age with 20 years ago. I'm like, oh shit.
I heard Beastie Boys come on the radio for that station. I was
yeah.
like,
when the classic state, yeah, the dad. It's always depressing, yeah.
Yeah, there was a thing going around on Twitter a few months ago that there was like an Apple playlist that had called like Arcade Fire and the Strokes dad rock, and people were losing their minds.
Oh,
whoa.
Oh my god.
But where is the mom rock though?
That's yeah, what right.
That'd be so much cooler.
I anticipate a merging of the literary and music worlds more and more in the future. I see a lot of musicians writing novels that are sort mm-hmm. of fiction, like Jeff Rickley did of Thursday. It was a
fantastic. He already has a literary sense. He's been a reader his whole life, and he had to write songs, which I think is the most difficult thing to write. I cannot even imagine trying to do that. And so if you're already challenging yourself in that way and writing something anyway, and you've built an audience, people are going to be receptive and want to publish whatever book you write. And you probably already have an inkling to do that to begin with. So I see more and more musicians with a certain number of followers or fans writing more. But I've seen with some of our friends and peers, musicians blurbing books.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know, maybe that's always been a thing, but I've seen it for the first time somewhat recently. And so that makes me hopeful that maybe the two worlds will collide more and more, and that books will therefore become a lot cooler as a result to the younger generations.
Jasmine has all the cool blurbs.
She does. Well, you know,
Sarah.
I know. That was legendary that they were down for that. You know, I reached out to like a lot of musicians because I do want the crossover I am actively trying to make that crossover happen. Like, we have a movie club's playing a show at the bookstore on Saturday with six readers reading over our instrumental psych rock songs. Like, I want to see more readings with live music involved. Like, we're all in the same pool, you know, of people that are just doing this passion thing, and it's very hard, and tech has found all the ways to get the money away and keep it from us. So the least we can do is try to create community and like cross feed. And that makes me very excited. And I do think it's kind of catching on. Like, it's not just like me out there doing it. Like, I've seen more things happening about that kind of merge those things.
Thank you for your work in that area. We have to really love it to be here, or we would have stopped.
Mm.
And there's something about the community that we have with each other because of that, that wouldn't be here otherwise.
Like, the problem is that because the money is not going to us, it's going to people in technology, and those are the worst people to have the money. And it's just all going in that direction overall. Like, Amazon should not be. I would much rather the bookstores, the indie bookstores, be making the money. The fact that Amazon just literally is just cornering every market, and like, they can just, you know, do whatever they want at this point. They're not making any money off books. They are just doing this to topple bookstores. Like, they make no money off book sales. Like, that's a true fact. So things like that, it's like, it's one thing if like it was just built in, but the fact that we can't make enough money and we have to do 80 million things, juggle all these hats just to like try to scrape together enough free time to write. Independently wealthy people are becoming like the people that get to make art, you know, very freely, and they're oversaturating the market. You know, you have to fight, you have to wear all the hats. So I just wish, you know, there was a little more camaraderie and less like cutthroat competition, because everyone's kind of starving and scrambling to make it work. And we all kind of have to like pretend we're not doing these like degrading things to like seem like we're making it work. You know what I mean?
Like, in terms of the whole camaraderie, I think the four of us just did like an amazing thing right now, where typically we should all be like competing a lot with each other's books.
No,
we should be in a knife fight currently.
Well, you know, like, the brotherhood's been going for many centuries, and the sisterhood really needs to catch up. So like, it makes me very happy and very, I feel very hopeful that we are all able to do this, and like, we all get to just kind of like speak and share our opinions in a nice environment that is really positive. So there is hope. There is hope. Yeah. I do think for camaraderie and sisterhood.
Jessamine, what you did with the Read and Rock and Rainbow tour was phenomenal. And I feel so lucky to have been at your launch at Book Soup because it was the best reading I've ever been to. And I've been to a lot of readings. That was, and I tend to, you know, I just tend to feel like, oh God, I got to go to a reading. Oh man, I got to go to a reading. And they're just not, they're so solitary, most of them. You brought people in. I mean, I felt a part of all of that, and you knew how to pace it. You knew how you wrote a rock novel, so you've got music included in the reading, and it was just terrific.
Thank you, Christy.
So I'm trying to make me cry. But, I mean, all of us weren't able to see it, but I think how you described how you got the audience to interact with you—that actually sounds like it was pretty rad as fuck.
Yeah, yeah. So congratulations to all of you for all that you're doing, from being in publishing Mallory to the rest of us, just, you know, the writing that we're doing and keeping on, keeping on. It's not easy, and it's a tough business. And I think this genre is one that I'm really passionate about. And I think you all are too. And I see so many subgenres of the rock novel. I mean, I've talked to people on Rock is Lit who've written science fiction rock novels and run awards with it. And they're horror rock novels. You know, Jessamine, you could have thrown that vampire in there and been in that subgenre.
Next time.
Yeah. It's going in all kinds of directions. It's really branching out right now. And I think it's really exciting. Well, thank you all for being here. This was a fabulous conversation, and I'm so glad I got the chance to meet you all, even if from afar. And thanks again, Jessamine, for putting a bug in my ear. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having us.
Let's start that club.
Yes.
Let's please say that. All right.
Thank you for tuning in, Lit listeners. You can find bios of each of the four guests on this episode in the show notes, as well as their social media handles and website addresses. Pick up a copy of their rock novels at your local indie bookstore or wherever you buy books. If you enjoyed this episode, Wyatt, the Rock is Lit mascot, and I would sure appreciate a 5-star rating and review on your podcast platform of choice. Until next time, keep rocking and reading and getting lit.
Rock is lit.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com. Code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.